What's good?
Welcome back to Co-Signed. If you're new here, I'm Mackenzie.
And I'm Sam. We're your hosts of this very real, raw, and hilarious podcast.
You're gonna love it.
So go ahead.
Grab your snacks, your coffee, your wine.
Whatever your vice is.
And let's get into it. Are you anxious, stressed, and true crime obsessed?
We are too!
Hey!
Welcome! So, we're actually obsessed with...
Literally.
Documentaries, crime shows, all that stuff. So, we decided we're going to do a fun little series for you guys.
True crime.
A true crime series.
Murder mystery meets.
So, throughout this series... we're going to list some must-see Netflix true crime shows, documentaries. Some of these are dramatizations, several are documentaries, and others are docu-series. All are based on true events.
Yes, and we do have a trigger warning before we list these must-see shows and documentaries. Several of these shows and documentaries discuss highly sensitive topics, including murder, sexual assault, animal abuse, violence, and more. Some were distressing for me to watch. Viewer discretion is advised.
All right, guys. So the first five this week that we're going to recommend that we have watched to go along with today's episode, Confessions of a Killer, the Ted Bundy tapes on Netflix.
If you have not seen this, I mean, all of these are really good. We have an entire list of them. But these first five are crazy.
Yes.
The best way. Well, disturbing.
The Ted Bundy tapes are very descriptive.
Yes.
So be prepared if you're going to watch them. It's not anything super gory or graphic. It's just more the he's very descriptive about what he did. The second is the movie based on Ted Bundy that Zac Efron played in. If you guys have not seen it, it's called Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile. Great movie. Like I said.
Again, it's a scripted version of his actual crimes, and it is based on real events. And I do have to say, even if the actual situations within the movie are disturbing, he played that part almost like too good.
Right.
Too good. It was like, oh, Zach, are you a Ted Bundy too?
Right.
Do we need to be worried about you?
A little graphic, but excellent movie.
Yes.
The second, Making a Murderer. There is a part one and part two.
So good. And it really honestly, so they have a dateline about that exact crime.
Right.
But the dateline is based from the police standpoint.
Yeah.
And this documentary, Making a Murderer, is based from the opposite side. And it honestly, like, I'm not going to lie. Like, I feel like he was framed.
Oh, yeah. I'm convinced.
That's all we're going to say about that, but definitely watch it because you see the links that some people go to.
And he's been in prison his whole life, so that'll mess you up a little bit watching it. It's not very as much like discretion advised, but emotionally.
Yeah.
Emotionally. The fourth, Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. Which Mackenzie lived there when this happened.
I did. I live like blocks away from the Cecil Hotel.
This is in California, by the way.
If you have not watched this, and even if you haven't watched the actual documentary, you'll remember the video as soon as they show you because it was viral.
Yeah.
But watch it. It's weird for me to say I enjoyed it, but remembering like the time period that it actually happened and then now seeing it, it kind of enlightens you a little bit.
And then we picked this one because if you watch the Cecil Hotel documentary, this kind of goes along with it. There was a serial killer that lived in the Cecil Hotel when the crime in that documentary was going on. So the Night Stalker, the hunt for a serial killer, number five.
Definitely watch it.
Related to the Cecil Hotel, very good documentary. But like I said, that one is a little graphic. Cecil Hotel gets a little graphic with how they explain the crime and what happened. So just be on the lookout for that. But those two are kind of connected, so we wanted to put those together.
Absolutely. And this show is not a documentary per se. It is a scripted show. But if you have not seen a single episode of Criminal Minds,
yes,
you have to watch it. They bring up a lot of true crimes, and they might not be a scripted version of them, but they do reference them, and they do speak true facts about these crimes. And it's just so interesting to really understand how actual profilers do their job.
Yeah.
And how true they are, because obviously a profiler is someone who understands a human psychology. Psychologically.
Yeah. So another cool thing about Criminal Minds, the character Rossi. If you watch long enough for Rossi to come into the show, Rossi is actually based on one of the true life main founders of that part of the Bureau in the FBI. BAU. So part of the BAU, he was one of the founders of it. And Rossi, that character, he plays it so well. So it's really interesting because they really stick to the facts a lot. There are a lot of episodes where you don't realize they're talking about prolific serial killers, but they are, and just changing the details.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the crimes in Criminal Minds are proven to be real crimes that they use to make this show. Mm-hmm. So super, super interesting show. Favorite crime show?
Honestly, hands down.
Hands down.
I loved it so much because Netflix only has, I think up until like season 10 or 11, yeah. And there's like 13 seasons, yeah. I think, or maybe more. But I loved it so much. I went on my Amazon, on my Fire Stick, and I purchased the last few seasons just to finish it because I was that addicted. So good. And just like the storyline within the show is awesome.
Right.
So.
Character storyline, everything. So definitely check out if you're into crime shows, true crime. Criminal Minds is one of the best realistic shows that I've seen when it comes to stuff like this that happens in real life. So.
Absolutely. So interesting fact. I Googled who is the biggest serial killer in the United States. I know it was weird for me to Google that, but since we were, I'm sure like somebody somewhere is like, oh, what is she?
Came out first for a reason.
So his name is Samuel Little. The most prolific serial killer in the U.S. has died at age 80. And this actual like headline came across December 31st of 2020. So he died just a few days before December 31st. But he died at the age of 80. Samuel Little had confessed to 93 murders in more than a dozen states over a course of 35 years. He was a convicted murderer who the FBI says is the most prolific serial killer in U.S. history. So, he's won an award for something.
It's kind of annoying that you can do that and still live to be 80.
I know. What? Obviously, he was in prison, but I mean, you literally killed all those people.
Where is karma here?
Justice system.
Right.
All right. So I'm going to start with my unsolved case. We decided to do one unsolved and one solved. So I'm going to start. The Black Dahlia is a still unsolved case. Elizabeth Short, a.k.a. the Black Dahlia, her case became highly publicized due to the graphic nature of this crime. So again, before I jump into the story, I am going to give a warning. This story is for mature audiences. It contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes and adult dialogue. Listener discretion is advised. So, Elizabeth was born July 29th, 1924. Fellow Leo.
Hey.
She was born in Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Her parents, Cleo and Phoebe Short, there's not much said about her upbringing except that she spent the early part of her childhood in Boston, or the Boston area, but at some point her parents divorced and her dad relocated to Vallejo, California, which if you don't know where that is, it's the Bay Area of California, but she ended up staying with her mother. When she became a young adult, she was beautiful. I mean, you look at pictures and I mean, for that time period, she really was just gorgeous. And it was noted that she had a nice figure, dark brown, black hair, and bright green eyes. And she always wore a flower in her hair. When she was 18, she was a bit of a wild child, apparently, like every other teenager out there. But she felt like she didn't belong in Massachusetts. The small town just wasn't doing it for her anymore. We can relate.
Can relate.
Relatable. Her and her father were still in communication, and at the time, he was working at the Navy Yards. And he told her, like, hey, come live with me, and in return, you won't have to pay any rent. All I ask is that you just cook, clean, just maintain the apartment while I'm at work, and, you know, all that jazz. And she decided to move in with her dad and agreed to do what they talked about, and she was so excited because, I mean, it's California. It's not Massachusetts. It was a fresh start for her. But when she got there, the stay with her father only lasted about 3 weeks. She wasn't with him for very long because apparently she would stay out all night and she wasn't really doing what she said that she was going to do. She wasn't keeping up with the apartment or his house, just was out and he could never get a hold of her. So her dad is actually the one who basically kicked her out. He basically said, hey, this isn't working. It's not helpful. Like, I thought you were going to come and actually help me. So bye. And Elizabeth ended up moving out. And sadly, that's the last time her dad said he saw or heard from her. So obviously, Elizabeth did not want to go back to Massachusetts. She was able to find a job as a, quote, camp cook on the military base that her dad worked on. And she worked at the Post Exchange, which, if you didn't know, the Post Exchange is a store where they sold food and clothes and those kinds of things. Now, she only worked there for about 9 months and she decided to leave. She then moved to San Diego. She had no plan, didn't have a place to stay, didn't have a job, but she just knew she wanted to go, so she went anyway. Very fly by the seat of the pants kind of gal.
Yeah.
So she gets there and she meets a woman named Dorothy who worked at an all-night theater. They don't have those anymore, but an all-night theater. And Elizabeth ends up telling Dorothy that she doesn't have anywhere to go. And since the two hit it off very well, Dorothy said, she offered Elizabeth a place to stay at her house. So she actually ends up staying with Dorothy from December of 1946 to January 1947. So January 9th, to be exact, and that's going to be important for the timeline. So January 9th, after that month, she told Dorothy that she was off to her, quote, next adventure. That's what Dorothy said. Someone by the name of Red was picking her up at the house. They said their goodbyes, and Dorothy saw Elizabeth get into a Studebaker coupe, and that was that. Now, the morning of January 15th, 1947, a 911 call comes into LA Dispatch Center to report what seems to be a dead body. Police go out to this location, and when they arrive, they are shocked, like bamboozled, if you will, right? When they arrived, they described what they saw as a naked body positioned on its back in the grass, steps away from the sidewalk in the middle of the suburbs. Pretty random place for a body back then, right? But what was the most concerning was the fact that the body was cut in half. They also didn't find an ID on or near the body, so obviously at the time they just referred to her as Jane Doe. Clearly we know now that it was Elizabeth, but her body was cut about an inch above her belly button, like clean cut. There are pictures of it, so if you want to go and ruin your day, just Google it, but that's all you need to know. Her body was cut in half. So her right breast was also cut off, and police noted that each of her big toes, just her big toenail, were painted red. And it looked like it had just been freshly done. No one knows why. Either maybe she did it, the killer did it, but just the two big toenails were painted red. A bright red. She also had deep cuts across her forehead and crisscross cuts on her private region. So whatever sicko did this also cut a game of tic-tac-toe into her hip. And it was, like, completed. The game of tic-tac-toe was completed. It wasn't just the graph. So it was her right hip, and it got me thinking, when was the last time that you played tic-tac-toe by yourself?
When I was a little kid.
So,
like, at the playground.
Me, like, personally thinking, I feel like there was two people. I don't feel like, unless he or she was making her do that to herself or, like, play with them. I don't know. But I'm just like, tic-tac, oh, I'm sorry. Are you bored mutilating my body? You got to take an intermission for a quick game of tic-tac-toe?
Yeah.
Like, it just was weird. So what many know about this case, though, was the fact that she had 3 inches on either side of her mouth cut. It's almost like a Joker smile. So it wasn't enough to cut her body in half, to cut off her right boob, carve a game of tic-tac-toe in her side, but now you want to give her a Joker smile.
Mm.
So a lot was happening, and that's creepy in itself. But it was also clear to the police that she was strangled due to the markings on her neck and marks on her arms and legs showing signs of being tied up by either a rope or a restraint of some kind. They also noted that her body had been face down for an extended period of time after she passed, and they know this because of the lividity on her front side. If you do not know what lividity means, it's where the blood pools and turns like the body like a blackish blue after you've passed. But this is important because it tells investigators if a body was moved or not after the crime. So like in this case, they found her face up, but she had clearly passed face down. So it was evident that she was placed at that scene. The crime didn't actually happen there. So now, all of that wasn't weird enough. The strangest thing of all, I think, was there was no blood. None at the crime scene. No blood on her body, no smears, no drops, nothing. And in case you missed the part about her smile and her being cut in half, like, there's supposed to be blood.
They cleaned her.
Her body was drained of all blood. I'm disturbed at this point. So the police had nowhere to go from here, no leads. They decided to call the woman who called 911. And it was about a week until they located her. And she said that she was just on a walk with her daughter and saw Elizabeth. And she thought that it was a mannequin at first because it looked so fake and she was so pale. But it scared her enough to call the police. But unfortunately, nothing came from the information they got from her. So once Elizabeth's body got to the coroner's office, they were able to get fingerprints, and that's how they ID'd her, because she didn't have anything on her. They located her father, and when he answered the door, he was completely wasted, drunk as a skunk, and pissed, by the way, angry that they were bothering him. The police told him that they had found his daughter, and he basically said, I don't care. And he didn't want to go down to ID the body. That's pretty effed up if you ask me.
Wow.
Yep. So then they call her mother, who was in Massachusetts still. She immediately flew to LA. They also tracked down Dorothy, which, because she stayed with her for an extended period of time, they asked her, when was the last time you've seen or talked to her? She explains how a man named Red came to pick her up, and that was the last time she saw or spoke to her. Police used this info and began to search all of the motels in the area, and they got to a motel in Pacifico Beach that showed up as one of the, like, the records show that a guest there was driving the exact same vehicle that Dorothy said that she saw. And it was registered to a man named Robert Monley, aka Red. They asked, they got a picture of Robert. They asked Dorothy if this is the man that you saw, and she said yes. So they're probably thinking, like, oh yeah, we got him, you know? So they look into this guy and they found that he actually lives in South Beach, California. He's married and works as a sales engineer. They also saw that on January 17th, just 2 days after the murder, he took off to San Francisco with some guy named Harry. So they end up sitting outside of Robert's actual house in South Beach, California, for like 2 days, waiting for him just to show up. And on January 19th, him and Harry finally roll back into town. Police take Robert into custody. They also search his car. So get this, they interrogated him and gave him 2 polygraph tests, and he passed both of them. They had nothing else on him. No, they didn't find anything in his car, so they had to release him. The media got a hold of the story, and people were obsessed just due to the nature of the crime, where she was found, all the stuff. And the media is actually the one who named her the Black Dahlia.
Yeah.
Just because of her dark hair and the flower in her hair. So a month goes by, the police have 0 suspects, and the community is getting very impatient. They don't feel safe. So because the media was covering this so heavily, there were quite a few people who came forward and confessed that they did it. But they had no actual evidence that they did it. They had no details. They just said, hey, I'm the one who did it. Why do you claim that you committed murder? I don't understand. So the LA Police Department received vivid letters on top of people coming in saying they did it. They were receiving very vivid, detailed letters that they believed came from the actual killer or someone who knew them, because they would also send belongings of hers with the letters. And one of the main things that they were sent was her address book. So back in the day, you know, you kept your itinerary, who you know, their address, their phone number, everything. They sent in her address book with one of their letters. But there were pages missing, ripped out of her address book, which makes police think that whoever did this, it was their information.
Right.
So they had no way, obviously, to get a hold of them because they don't know who's sending the letters. They weren't, there was no address or anything. It was just addressed to the police department. By February 5th, 1947, this is almost a month after all this has happened, two arrests were made for this case. Robert, aka Red, and another man named Dan. Once again, they got nowhere with Red, had to let him go again. And then the other man, Dan, actually confessed, but later said that he was mentally unwell, and that's why he said he did it, but he didn't actually do it. I don't know why people are just confessing the crimes they didn't commit, but... police had another suspect, though. An infamous Hollywood doctor named George Hodel. I think that's how you say it. George's friends actually recognized Elizabeth's picture in the papers, and one of his friends is actually who gave the tip to the police and said that they had briefly dated, Elizabeth and George, and that they recognized her because she would hang out at some of his like shady parties at his home where he threw most of them. George had issues, and that's even an understatement. He honestly should have been in prison. There was a whole entire scandal about him and his 14-year-old daughter.
Oh, my God.
And that's a story in itself, and it's very graphic, so I will not go into that. But it is, he should have been in prison. But because of his shady past, he becomes the main suspect, and police knew that they needed a confession. But since he was so rich, they knew that it wasn't going to be easy to get anything from him. He'll either just lawyer up or shut up. They actually, at some point, bugged his home. So, which is actually illegal without, you can't just bug somebody's home, but it's the police, right? So, are you ready for some juicy details?
I'm ready.
They start listening to every, like, all of his daily conversations. I mean, at this point, they're not listening.
Yeah.
They're constantly listening to him. And on February 18th, 1950, this was literally like 3 years. Yes. Okay. Around 8:30 p.m., they hear a woman scream multiple times. Now, since they're listening to his every move at this point, it was already noted that there was no female had been heard since before 6:30 that evening. So this was 8:30 that they heard this woman scream. They didn't even know anybody was in the home except him. So they rush in, they search his house, they find nothing. Nothing. Right. They later hear him, later on that night, making a phone call, and he's saying something along the lines of, quote, putting a pillow over her face and covering her with a blanket. Now, after some time passes on the phone, they hear him say again, quote, suppose I did kill the Black Dahlia. They couldn't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary anymore because she's dead. His secretary had just recently passed from a supposed overdose. Mm-hmm. This is all very sketchy, by the way. I mean, obviously. But by April 1950, they had enough evidence to charge George with the murder, but they were too late. He had already fled the United States. They had nowhere, they don't know where he went. Yes. And the case goes cold again. Now, November 24th, 1950, a woman named Christine Reynolds, she called the Oakland Tribune and told them that she was going to turn herself in and confess to murder, making her at this moment in time the 27th person to confess to this crime. 27th. Almost 30 people have confessed before you. And I'm sure the police were like, okay, whatever you say, lady.
Right.
You're crazy pants. But something was different with her story. She told the police that Elizabeth was living with her at the time of her death. But she knew her as Libby instead of Elizabeth. And they met at a Hollywood bar. And that they had an affair of their own. As in they were seeing each other. Christine tells police that she caught Elizabeth running around with another woman while they were together. And 4 days before the murder, Christine went out looking for Elizabeth because she wasn't home. And that's when she found her at a bar with another woman named Louise. They got into an argument and they left the bar. On the way home, Christine said that they were arguing and she leaned over and began to choke Elizabeth, but Elizabeth was fighting back. Elizabeth manages to get out of the car and she runs up the street. Christine says that she parks the car, walks up behind Elizabeth, and puts her in a chokehold. She then remembers that she has a knife and starts to stab Elizabeth and leaves her there. Now, investigators aren't buying it because obviously when they found the body, like I said, there was no blood at the scene. But,
and you're cut in half.
This is a big but. There was one detail in Christine's story that was never made public knowledge. It's pretty graphic, so I'm going to give you the Cliff Notes version. She cut off some of her hair and shoved it up you know what. Okay. But police told Christine that they knew she was lying despite what she was saying. Christine ends up breaking down, crying, and saying that she was lying, that she had a girlfriend who worked in the police department who told her all of these details. And she just confessed to all this. But instead of going and asking Christine, okay, who's giving you these details? What's this girlfriend's name? They never looked into it. They didn't ask questions. They just released Christine and went on about their business. So around this time, there was also a drawing, sketch really, that came into a police department in North Carolina, across the country, that they then sent it to the LA Police Department. And on this sketch was a man's face and then written, "Black Dahlia killer, look this man up." And I've seen the sketch. You can Google it. It looks like George. Like, identical to George. Who, like I said, fled the states. So while this case still remains unsolved, there was a suspect that was always at the top of the list. Someone who checked all of the boxes for the police and fit the profile. But he or she always remained unknown. They didn't know a name. But the signs were coming from Cleveland, Ohio, which had a string of murders happening before Elizabeth. All the bodies were cut in half. And if you've ever watched Criminal Minds, like we just said, you know what that means. It's a pattern. So this serial killer became known as the Cleveland Torso Killer, who had allegedly moved out west. And it's believed that Elizabeth was his or her final victim. So all of this is very tragic, but that is the unsolved case of Elizabeth Short. And when she passed, she was 22 years old.
Oh my God.
Now, I do have a sidebar. George had a son, and his name was Steve. And this entire time, Steve felt like his father was actually guilty and committed this crime among other crimes. So he decided to do some digging into his father's past. And I did read that George was constantly in and out of the United States. Like, he would come home for a month or two and then leave again.
Perfect
come
for a home serial killer.
For a month or two and then leave again, which is what Steve said, his son. So in 2013, so remember 1947, 1950 to 2013.
Right.
So that was not that long ago. The soil behind George's house, because he never sold his house, it stayed in the family. The soil behind George's house was tested for human remains, and the test was positive. Now, obviously, the downside to the test is that it just says positive or negative. It can't actually tell you who's there, the DNA, when it was there, all that stuff. It can't tell you a timeline. But some people think that he, in fact, he was the killer of Elizabeth and had done a bunch of these other crimes. But some think that Steve just had, like, a major vendetta against his dad and, you know, was trying to air out dirty laundry or, like, frame him or something, so.
But the doctor thing fits so well.
He would have known.
No blood to cut someone in half.
That's what I was thinking, too. And to my knowledge, I think they thought that he, like, fled to, like, the Philippines or something, but they could never get anything from him to charge him. Who knows? Maybe the next part of this series I'll cover the Cleveland Torso Killer. Who knows? We'll see where that goes.
That's a Criminal Minds episode, but it's called something else. Mm-hmm.
See if we can connect any dots.
All right, so we are done with the unsolved. Now we are going to move to the solved, which is super famous. Most of you will probably know.
Yes, and again, before Sam jumps into this story, we're going to give another warning. This story is definitely for mature audiences only. It contains very graphic descriptions of crime scenes and does contain adult dialogue. So listener discretion is advised.
All right, guys, so one of the most famous serial killers of all time. Most of us, if you watch TV at any point in your life, you will know about Ted Bundy. Just to start, if you guys didn't know, he would capture, torture, rape, murder his victims. And he is also, which I did not know until I researched, he was a necrophiliac, which...
If you do not know what that means.
If you do not know what that means... is when you have sex with dead bodies. Just to start with a little history with Ted Bundy. Some sources have multiple suspicions of who Ted's father actually was, while some rumors had it that his father was actually his grandfather as well. So, Ted's birth certificate lists his father as unknown. His biological father's identity has never been confirmed. So, Bundy started his life as his mother's secret shame. As his illegitimate birth humiliated her parents, they were very religious, so it was very humiliating for them at this time that she became pregnant. So, his mother's name was Louise. Louise delivered Ted at a home, so her parents sent her to a home to give birth to illegitimate children. So she delivered Ted at a home for unwed mothers in Vermont. She left without him.
Yeah.
She left him there. She went home and her dad was like, no, you're going to go get him and you're going to bring him back and we're going to raise him.
Mm.
So her father made her go back
and
pick him up and bring him home.
Which makes you wonder if he was the dad.
Exactly. To hide the fact that he was the illegitimate child, Bundy was raised as the adopted son of his grandparents and was told that his mother was his sister. Eleanor moved with Bundy to Washington a few years later and soon married his stepfather, Johnny, in 1951. She had multiple children with Ted's stepfather, Johnny. Ted expressed in interviews that he resented his stepfather for being uneducated and working class.
Wow.
His mother refused to believe the charges against Ted for years until he finally confessed. Around the age of 3, his family said he became fascinated with knives. As a teenager, he was caught stealing and also peering into his neighbor's windows.
Right, I saw like a little piece of information that said that his aunt actually like woke up to find like an assortment of knives around her, and allegedly they were put there by Ted Bundy at 3 years old, and he was standing at the foot of her bed, like, just staring at her when she woke up.
I believe that.
I do, too.
I believe that. So,
what's she gonna lie about?
When his mom married his stepfather, in case you guys didn't know, they had 3 other children together.
Yeah.
So, Ted was always, like, the outcast.
Right.
And they had said in the documentary, he found his birth certificate that said unknown under the father.
Right.
So Bundy lied in interviews about his academic performance and his social life. He would glamorize being one of the top students in academics among his peers, but when in fact he was average in school and considered a social outcast.
Yeah.
Never had girlfriends, never went to school dances, nothing. So he graduated from the University of Washington with a degree in psychology in 1972. He was then accepted to law school in Utah. But he never earned his degree, which we know why.
Too busy killing me.
Right. One of his high school friends expressed feelings of shock that Bundy would choose the University of Washington instead of a bigger school. So Bundy later came to confess in the tapes that he moved and changed his whole life to get rid of anything unique about himself. So while a student at the University of Washington, Bundy fell in love with a wealthy woman from California. She was wealthy. She had class, and she had a lot of influence with her family. So he expressed in his tapes he was devastated by their breakup and, quote-unquote, wanted revenge on her at times. Many of Bundy's later victims resembled his college girlfriend, attractive students with long, dark hair.
Yep, and parted down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Criminal bias is a pattern.
Right.
He's a profile.
Bundy would like constantly change his appearance.
Mm-hmm.
He would change his hair color, his hairstyle, how long it was, how short it was. He would wear glasses. He would wear no glasses. He would change his clothes.
Yep. If you watch the movie where Zach plays him also, it shows that too.
His first murder that is known and recorded, February 1974. He abducted Linda Healy. She was 21, where the main campus of the University of Washington is located. She was known in the community for giving the weekday ski report on the radio. March 1974, 1 month later, Bundy kidnapped and murdered Donna Manson. She was 19. She was a student at Evergreen State College in Olympia. Her body has never been recovered. April 1974, he abducted and killed Susan Rancourt. She was 18, a student at Central Washington University in Ellensburg. May 1974, he abducted Kathy Parks. She was 20, from Oregon State University, so he's crossing state lines now, around 11 p.m. He claimed that he raped and killed her at Taylor Mountain, more than 25 miles south of Seattle. June 1st, 1974, he abducted Brenda Ball. She was 22 in the town of Burien, south of Seattle. Her skull was later found at Taylor Mountain. Oh. So we go to June 11th, 10 days later. He kidnapped and killed 18-year-old Georgianne Hawkins from the University District of Seattle. He claimed to have knocked her unconscious and strangled her. Then we go a month later, July. So we're at 6 months. One girl every month.
Basically.
Two girls in June. So now we're July 1974 at Lake Sammamish. Bundy abducted Janice Ott. She was 23. And Denise Naslin, who was 19. His first double abduction. Witnesses described a handsome young man who called himself Ted. At this point, he has killed 8 women in 6 months. He's basically...
They're just missing at this point.
People weren't looking multiple districts across.
Right.
You know? So he's being smart, crossing districts, crossing states. They're
thinking it's 8 separate cases.
Right. September 1974. A hunter discovered the remains of Janice Ott, Denise Naslin, Georgianne Hawkins, 1 mile east of an old railroad trestle just out of Washington.
So he buried those three together.
Together.
Which, again, I know we keep bringing up Criminal Minds, but it's very interesting to read about these cases and then have already seen Criminal Minds, because even in that show, they always go back to a familiar place. Yep. And it sounds like that's what he did.
Absolutely. October 1974, he abducted, raped, and strangled Melissa Smith. She was only 17. Her body was discovered a week later.
Probably all disheveled because they found his first three.
October 31st, he kidnapped, raped, and murdered Laura Amy. She was 17 as well, from Utah. Her remains were found that Thanksgiving Day in a mountainous area. Her poor family. 8 days later, he attempted to abduct Carol DeRanche. She was 18. She was at a Fashion Place mall in Utah. Mm-hmm. She fought him very heavily. And what ended up making him leave her alive was that other people were coming up on the scene and he left.
Right.
So just a few hours later, the same day.
Takes it out on somebody
else. Deborah Kent. Her father gave her the keys to the car to pick up her brothers from the skating rink. She never even made it to her parents' car. She was 17. Bundy claimed in an interview with the sheriff's department that he left her body in a grave, but it's never been found.
So I couldn't get the one I wanted, so now I'm just going to go get...
anyone.
Anybody.
Yeah.
Just because I have the urge to do so.
January 1975, he abducted Karen Campbell. She was 23, Wildwood Inn in Colorado. 36 days later, her body was discovered 3 miles from the inn, and she had blows to her head. So that was in January. He didn't kill anyone until March 1st of that year again. So while he was in Salt Lake City, Utah, the remains of Linda Healy, Susan Rancourt, and Kathy Parks, Brenda Hall, were all found by Eagle Scouts on Taylor Mountain in Washington. Their skeletal remains all showed they suffered severe blunt force trauma.
Very confident in his ability to not get caught.
So they were discovered March 1st. March 15th, he abducted and killed a ski instructor, Julie Cunningham. She was 26, from Vail, Colorado. Her body's never been found. He just admitted to it. April, he killed Denise Oliverson. She was 24. He said he left her body in the Colorado River, but it has never been recovered. May 1975, he kidnapped and drowned Lynette Culver. She was 12.
Oh my gosh.
He drowned her in a bathtub. And later said he discarded her body in the Snake River, but her remains have never been found either.
So I didn't know about the 12-year-old.
June 1975, he kidnapped and killed Susan Curtis. She was 15. Mm. She was attending the Bountiful Orchard Youth Conference. Bundy claimed he buried her body near a highway, but her remains have never been found either. August 1975, at 2:30 a.m., he was arrested for the first time in Granger, Utah, after a chase by highway patrol. Police found masks, gloves, rope, and a crowbar and handcuffs in his car. He was released on bail the next day.
Oh my gosh. You have bodies popping up everywhere, and right. You find someone who has these items, but...
So,
wow.
After he's caught and released, so he's released on bail the next day, 2 months later, they bring Carol DeRonchin,
right,
the survivor. He was identified in a lineup by her, so that was the start of his demise. But before I go into that, I want to talk about Ted Bundy had a long-term girlfriend. Crazy but common. Her name was Elizabeth Kendall. So she dated Bundy from 1969 to 1974 when he started his killing. So she was basically like that one female he would never hurt.
Right.
She lived with him.
Right.
So he's killing these women and then he's coming home. And she has no clue. Elizabeth Kendall is actually the reason that he ended up getting caught. There was a bolo out on the TV and the radio at the time that described this gentleman. They had a sketch from the survivor. And she said, I don't think that it's him, but the sketch kind of looks like him. And he drives his car. And they actually said, after she was talking to them for a little bit, she actually hung up on them. She even said, his name is Ted.
Yeah.
Ted Bundy was not even on their radar until she called. And that was when they were going through, they start talking about, oh, well, these timelines match. He was here at this time. He's been here before. So I wanted to throw that in there because that was before he was ever arrested for the first time she called.
Yeah.
After he's identified by the victim that he left alive. November 1974, he was arrested and charged with aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault on Carol DeRonch. He was held in Salt Lake County Jail. So that was November 1974. So in February 1976,
oh, wow,
his trial began. He waived his right to a jury trial. On March 1st, he was found guilty of aggravated kidnapping. And he was sentenced to a minimum of 1 to 15 years in a Utah state prison. He's charged with that in February 1976. We go all the way to October of that year. He's charged with Karen Campbell's murder. Then we go to January of 1977. He was moved in prison to Aspen, Colorado to face charges for Campbell's murder. Then in May of 1977, he pled not guilty to the murder.
Right.
June 1977, he assisted in his own defense in the case.
Right.
He was allowed access to the Pitkin County Jailhouse Law Library. He escaped from the second story window of the library, which was 20 feet above the ground. He wasn't captured until 5 days later after spending that time in the nearby mountains and back in Aspen. He went back into custody at a facility in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. And on June 15th, 1977, he was charged with escape, burglary, and felony theft. So December 1977... he escaped from his own jail cell.
Mm-hmm.
He had actually opened a light fixture in his jail cell. So he stored books and other belongings on his bed below a blanket to appear as if he were in the bed sleeping. Mm-hmm. He escaped, right, in December.
Mm-hmm.
We go to January. After flying to Chicago, then taking a train to Michigan.
He got on a plane with what ID?
He had fake IDs.
Somebody was giving those to him in prison. Yeah. Probably many of his, like, wives-to-be.
Right. Psycho women.
Looney Tunes.
So he goes to Chicago, flies there, then he takes a train to Michigan. Then he drives a stolen car all the way to Atlanta.
Let's add Grand Theft Auto to this.
Drives in a stolen car from Michigan to Atlanta without getting stopped. Then keeps driving.
It wasn't a Volkswagen. They were looking for it.
Oh, he don't stop it. He don't stop in Atlanta. He drives all the way to Tallahassee, Florida.
Oh.
Then, a couple weeks later, This is actually really sad. So, on January 15th, 1978, he entered a sorority house near Florida State University and killed Margaret Bowman and Lisa Levy. They were both beaten severely and strangled to death. He also, so Karen Chandler and Kathy Kleiner, suffered severe injuries because he bludgeoned them while they were asleep and he left them because he thought they were dead. But they actually survived. Shortly after the sorority house attacks, Bundy broke into the apartment of Cheryl Thomas, a student at FSU, and attacked her. Her housemates, who lived on the other side of the wall, heard the noise and called Thomas's apartment, but she didn't answer. They then called the police. Bundy escaped before authorities arrived, but Thomas survived the attack.
So making up for time that he couldn't get to anybody.
Oh, yeah.
While he was in prison.
So that was January 15th, so now we're February 9th. So he's been on the loose for a month
right.
at this point. Bundy kidnapped and murdered a 12-year-old girl, Kimberly Leach. She disappeared in the middle of the school day. She was his youngest victim, and she was also his last. That's February 9th, so we go to February 15th. David Lee, a patrolman with the Pensacola Police Department, noticed a suspicious car loitering and driving erratically. The officer ran the plates and discovered the car was stolen. Bundy refused to give his name and resisted arrest. The officer was able to subdue him after a struggle and arrested him. But back at the police station, Bundy gave officers a stolen ID and said he was an FSU student named Kenneth. They arrest him because basically this student, Kenneth, saw himself on the news and came forward.
Right.
And was like, okay, I'm home.
I'm Kenneth.
I am not here.
Right.
So then when they're back at the police station, he's in court. And they still don't know who he is. It's been a few days. He won't say who he is. And the judge on film says, I cannot consider releasing you until I know who you are.
Right.
So he stays in custody for a couple days. And on February 17th, he finally reveals his true identity to the police. Then we go to July. He was indicted for the murders of Margaret Bowman and Lisa Levy. And the attempted murders of the other three that right. he tried to kill in the sorority house. Bundy rejected a plea deal that would have allowed him to avoid the death penalty if he admitted to murdering those girls
right.
in Florida.
It's just crazy.
So in an interview, his attorney discloses that the plea deal was offered to Bundy before his trial. In private, Bundy had accepted it because it was the only way that he could avoid the death penalty. So all the courts, all the attorneys have it lined up. He's going to accept this plea deal. And that's going to, they're going to move right. forward.
Because anybody would have just accepted it.
Right. In court, it said officers and attorneys were expecting him to accept the plea. But instead, Bundy stands up right before and tells the judge that in his opinion, he did not have fair counsel because his attorney team had expressed that they could not come up with a defense that would spare him and that he was convinced his legal team thought he was guilty. He said he has never had any intention of accepting guilt. His attorney expressed that he was humiliated and asked the judge to excuse them as Bundy's counsel altogether. The judge was tired of the trial being put on the back burner and refused the motion, which ordered his attorney team to remain.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you had to defend someone who's, you know, one, they're crazy. And right. two, just literally embarrassed you in front of the entire court. Ugh.
The judge allowed Bundy to be co-counsel in his own defense, which his attorney stated was ridiculous because he wasn't even an actual licensed attorney right. at all. Bundy was convinced that he would win his case and be released. Bundy was allowed to cross-examine the officers and the witnesses of all his crimes.
No.
And he would over and over make them repeat every detail that they saw.
Right.
So in July of 1979, he was found guilty of murdering Levy and Bowman and the attempted murders of the other three in the sorority house. 1 week later, he was sentenced to death for the murders. In February of 1980, he was found guilty of Leach's kidnapping and murder and was also sentenced to death again. 6 years later, in 1986, after Florida Governor Bob Graham signed two death warrants for the sorority house case, the 11th Circuit Court signed a permanent stay of execution 15 minutes before he was scheduled to be executed.
My gosh.
if any man could get every lucky, like, you have a four-leaf clover up your asshole at this point.
And I'm just going to say, once you watch the documentary and you watch the people talking about him and you watch the movie, that's what he did. Like, he charmed people.
Yeah.
That's how he basically got away with this for so long. So it really honestly wouldn't surprise me if he was just charming the pants off everybody that signed this shit.
That's what I'm saying.
It's disgusting. Wonder how they feel about themselves.
Mm-hmm. So that's 1986. 3 years later, Governor Bob Martinez signed the second death warrant in the Leach case. So, over the next several days, Bundy confessed to various law enforcement agents. Bundy told FBI Special Agent Bill Hagmeier he killed 30 people in California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Utah, Colorado, and Florida between 1973 and 1978. So, think about that. His first murder was recorded in 1974, but he said 1973.
So, he was doing it before. Or his very first one we just don't know about.
So, they went in. And he's like, Ted, you know, what if we talk about...
Like, essentially third person.
Right.
Storytelling. And tell us the story.
And he's basically hyping him up. He's like, you know, you're a psychology major. You're so intelligent. If you were to tell us what you think happened here, how do you think it would go?
Right, describe it
and
to us.
And he just spilled his guts. So on January 24th in 1989... Around 7 a.m., he was strapped to the electric chair, and he was pronounced dead.
Mm. I read that one of the many, while he was in prison, one of the many, many, many psychologists or therapists, whatever, that would talk to him. There was one in particular, and I can't remember her name, but she was one of the main ones that always came and talked to him. And right before he was... sentenced to death, I think it was the day before, mm-hmm. a few days before, he requested her to come talk to him. Mm. And she originally, upon her diagnosis of him, many people, I mean, have their own, you know, reason, oh, he's this, he's that, and the third. But she originally had said that he had diagnosed him with bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But she then changes it, antisocial something disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And she was saying that she felt like he was a true psychopath. That he does not feel remorse. That as he was being taken out of that room, he leans over and kisses her on the cheek and smiles at her. And that's the last time she saw him. And they asked her if she felt, like, sad. And she was like, I didn't shed a tear when I heard that he was actually dead.
Crazy, crazy story. Everyone talks about Ted Bundy. But if you've never actually, like, read the case or watched anything on it, it's a lot worse than people just, oh yeah, Ted Bundy, the serial killer.
Right. I have an interesting fact. So, the movie The Silence of the Lambs, which you haven't seen, but I read that The Silence of the Lambs was inspired by a real-life relationship between University of Washington's criminology professor and profiler Robert Capel and serial killer Ted Bundy. So, that movie was inspired by those three, and a creepy movie. So, but guys, we are super excited for this series. Not super sure how long it's gonna be, but we're gonna continue with the solved and unsolved cases and see what we come across. We love this kind of stuff, as weird as that may be. It's just interesting to the psychology part of it, in my opinion. It's just interesting to see, like, why people do these things or how far they're willing to go or just all kinds of stuff. So,
and I was gonna ask you, because I told you about that meme where it's like, you know, women actually like drink wine and watch serial killer documentaries to relax. Uh-huh. That's a real thing.
That is. Like Snap. I'm a Snap fiend.
Right. But I was asking myself, what is it about it that fascinates me so much? And it's not the actual crime and it's not the murder. It's why.
Right.
It's the brain aspect of it.
Right.
Why can doctors that study brains look at an image of six different brains and they can tell you exactly which ones belong to a serial killer? Right.
Or a psychopath.
Why is it some people and not others? Why is it this victim and not this victim? Why do you go past this person walking freely on the street but break into this house to get this one?
Or stalk this person and make it a point to figure, like, find, like, know their routine enough to just, like, or even to go so far like he did and, like, pose as a cop. And, like, to what extent?
I think that's why people are so fascinated, is because we can't understand
it. Because not ever, right. And I was going to say, people say, like, oh, well, they had trauma or they did this or that. Everyone experiences trauma.
Right.
And some of them are very, you know, some of them are bigger traumas than others, but everybody experiences trauma. So that's not an excuse.
Right.
So unless it's because they don't react to that trauma in the same way or process the trauma in the same way. Like, it's like you said, it's just the brain factor. All right, guys. Well, that is all we have for the episode today. We really, really hope that you learned something and or enjoyed this true crime episode that we hope to continue in the near future.
Yeah, if you guys have any...
Or if you have a case that you want us to talk about, or maybe an interesting fact that about one of these cases that we didn't say, leave us a DM on Instagram or a voice message.
My favorite.
On Anchor. Our Instagram is co.signpodcast. If you go to the link in our bio, you'll find the link to the voice messages all right there for you. And we are going to be doing a giveaway very soon. We're waiting to get to 100 followers on Instagram. It's been a slow and sweet process, but we are at 80. So just a few more to go. We're going to be dropping a hot giveaway. So you want to go ahead and make sure that you're following us so you know when we're doing it.
Yeah, because you have to follow us to win.
For a chance to win.
When I'll check them down.
But as usual, as always, every single Tuesday, we're coming at you with a brand new
every Tuesday
episode. Hey. Do the Ariana whistle tone. All right, guys, we will see you next week.
All right, bye, guys.
Oh my god. Oh my god.